Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, dear eloquent chairman and generous too, my sheikh, my leader, my mentor, my brother, and my fellow speaker at the next event in SOAS, to which, if you'll forgive us, we must flee at the end of this, distinguished scholars, religious leaders, brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum. It's, as Dr. Halbawi said, a great honor to be invited to address this august occasion. And the subject which has been chosen for me happens to be the subject on which I think, write, speak, broadcast almost every day of my life. So there's no need for notes, because I feel that this subject, indeed all of my life, has been in preparation for these days when we are at a turning point in what the agenda calls the West's exploitation of the Islamic world and its perfidious interference. Of course, that interference continues. Of course, the evil has not been yet defeated. But as Dr. Halbawi said, one by one falling like bricks, he said, they are falling like bricks, and soon their whole house will come tumbling down. Because this Islamic awakening, this Arab revolution, this Islamic awakening, which can be dated back actually not to the Arab world, but to the great Islamic revolution in Iran 32 years ago, is on the march. The people are no more afraid of the puppet presidents and the corrupt kings which imperialism has placed for so long on the thrones and in the chanceries of the Muslim countries. The Muslims have awakened, and they will not, I believe, go back to sleep until their job is done. I sat for almost a quarter of a century in the British Parliament. As such, I had to walk past every day the very rooms in which the 20th century crimes against the Muslims were plotted and planned. I passed the room every day where Mr. Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary, with his infamous declaration, which is a mark of shame upon this country which has never been acknowledged, never mind atoned for, where Mr. Balfour, in a crime unique even by imperialist standards, decided on behalf of one people to promise to a second people the land of a third people. And what made it unique, of course, was that Britain did not even possess, even as an imperialist possession, the land that it was giving away. Giving away, by the way, to a group of atheist Jews who called themselves the Zionist movement, and who had already been negotiating with the British government and others for other territories in the world in which they might build their state, their colonial white European settler state, which they would call Israel. It's worth remembering that, because it's only long after the event that they invented the biblical justification, the historical religious justification for their possession of Palestine. They were negotiating with the British to build Israel in Uganda. If they had been permitted, then we might now have a Ugandan refugee problem and a ULO instead of the PLO. They negotiated with the British and others to take possession of what has turned out, actually, ironically, to be an enormously oil and gas rich province of Argentina called Patagonia. At least in those circumstances, it still would have been the PLO, because they were ready to build their settler state anywhere that they could persuade one of the imperial powers to give them this land. And only later, when they invented the idea that Palestine was a land without people, which should be given to them, a people without a land, did they come up with their mumbo jumbo about God being an estate agent, about a merciful God who would visit such a national and human disaster on people in their own country by allowing their country to be wiped off the map and their people to be scattered to the four corners of the earth, hunted from pillar to post, regularly massacred, people without passports, papers, status, living in their millions now as refugees. The lucky ones here in London, maybe some in the audience, the unlucky ones living in rancid refugee camps in the Arab countries nearby Palestine, where they are treated in some cases like dogs. In Lebanon, for example, the Palestinian refugees, in their hundreds of thousands, are not permitted to go to school outside their camps. They're not permitted to go to hospitals outside their camps. They're not permitted to perform any of a list of 49 occupations, which are essentially all the occupations you would ever want your son or your daughter to perform. And they're not allowed, of course, to leave their camps easily at all. The Palestinian people were the victims of British double think and double speak. Even the Balfour Declaration itself, which is only 142 words long, imagine, 142 words that have caused so much misery for so many decades, nearly a century now. It's 142 words long. And it promises the land of Palestine to these atheist Zionist Jews. But of course, without prejudice, it says, to the existing rights of the existing people living in Palestine. Well, you all know what happened to those existing rights, how prejudiced they were. You all know that Palestinians living in what they call the Green Line, as so-called citizens of Israel, live as third-class citizens, discriminated against at every turn. You all know that the so-called West Bank of the River Jordan has been illegally occupied by brute military force for 45 years. You all know that that West Bank is now disfigured with the ugliest settlements, which is a word which doesn't convey properly what these places are. They are cities. They look like Beverly Hills, and they're always on a hill, and they're always using for their sprinklers and their swimming pools and the lives of luxury that the people in them lead at the international taxpayers' expense. Lives of indescribable luxury compared to the people whose land on which those settlements are built. You know about the apartheid wall, which the International Court decreed was illegal, but which continues to stand, indeed, to grow, separating, as Dr. Helbawi said, the very relations between the Palestinian people. Families unable to communicate with each other, farmers unable to harvest their fields, separating towns and villages. You all know about the checkpoints which disfigure that land. Hundreds and hundreds of checkpoints at which Palestinian people are held for hours or for days or permanently unable to travel. Not just Muslims, by the way. Mary could not make the journey now from Nazareth to Bethlehem. It's not possible to make it. She would have had to give birth, no doubt, at a checkpoint, like so many women today are doing, even as we speak. We know what happened to Gaza, which had the temerity to vote, as did the Palestinian people as a whole, for an Islamic government that Britain and America and Israel did not like. They were subjected to year after year of total blockade and siege. And then, when they were hungry and weak, when their children were dying of malnutrition, all the doors were locked, and rockets and bombs and missiles and gas, imagine, were rained down upon them in so-called Operation Cast Lead. And of course, most of the doors that were locked, so they had nowhere to run, nowhere to hide, were Israeli doors. But one of them was an Arab door, locked by a man who called himself Muhammad Hosni Mubarak, imagine. The man who almost exactly 2 years ago deported me from his country and, or the country he held in illegal possession, I should say, deported me from Egypt, declaring me persona non grata. I told the official at the airport who decreed so and pushed me physically onto the plane, the day will come when it will be your master who's behind bars. It will be your master who will face the justice and the wrath of the great people of the great Egypt. Alhamdulillah, this has come to pass. And you'll forgive me if I, to use a German word, daily experience a Schadenfreude as I see him wheeled in, looking ever so poorly and unable to face justice. Well, he may not in the end face justice in Egypt, but on the last day, on the judgment day, he's got a lot of explaining to do, this criminal, Muhammad Hosni Mubarak, and his locking of the gates, which led to the slaughter of Palestinians, thousands of Palestinians in a tiny place, killed or maimed or wounded, hundreds of them now amputees, single amputees, double amputees, triple amputees. This great crime was, of course, supported to the nth degree by the so-called democracies of the West, whose arms were being dropped on the Palestinian people. And our government sent, I just remembered this the other day, looking at a speech I'd given that was on YouTube. Our government, Gordon Brown, sent the Royal Navy to Gaza. Was it to protect the refugees, as was his international obligation? No. He sent the Royal Navy to the coast of Gaza to stop any weapons arriving that could be used by the defenders of the Palestinian refugees under siege in Gaza. And last, but very definitely not least, you all know what has happened to Jerusalem. From where? From the roof of Al-Aqsa, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, ascended to the heavens and returned with the revelation, and which is in the hands of the foreign army. All of these years, Jerusalem is being ethnically and religiously cleansed of Christians and Muslims as we speak this day, and has been illegally annexed, not occupied, annexed. They refuse even to discuss Jerusalem, which they say is theirs. Well, I've got news for them. The tide has turned by the grace of God. It will soon no longer be theirs and will be in the hands of all of those who revere it and its holy places. And every day I passed another room, a room where a man called Sykes and a man called Pico, the first a British, the second a French official, who sat down 1 year later after Balfour, with their pencils and their maps and drew lines on those maps and declared, decreed, this country is called this, that country is called this, this is no more one country, it's now two, in order to divide the Arab world, the better to rule it, the better to steal its things. Well, that too is an era which is now coming to an end. The West spent the next 80 years stealing the bounty that God gave the people of that region, leaving the mass of the people in underdevelopment, poverty. Take Yemen, for example. I've just been talking to Sheikh Hamid Al-Ahmar, the leader of the revolution in Yemen. He was making the point. Yemen is the poorest country in the world. Can you believe it? It's the poorest country in the world, yet it is situated in the Gulf. Its next door neighbors are so rich that the casinos and the bordellos and the property markets and the arms markets of Western countries would go bankrupt if they stopped buying and pleasuring themselves there. Yet their neighbor, fellow Muslims, fellow Arabs, are living in the poorest country in the world, according to official statistics. The West kept these tyrants in power, and these tyrants in return allowed the West to steal the resources that God had given to the Muslim people of that region. How's that for interference? How's that for perfidy? But there is a new danger to which Dr. Helbawi might well have been alluding when I entered. The new Sykes-Picot danger, I call it, having failed to reach their century in dividing the Muslims into fake countries and fake boundaries and fake petty nationalisms. A huge international effort is underway to divide the Muslim people again, this time on the basis of confession. Don't be fooled. The West doesn't care whether somebody's a Shia or a Sunni. Not at all. They don't love Sunnis, though it might look like it on the news today. They don't hate Shiites. They love the Shah of Persia, who, so far as I know, was a Shiite of a kind. They support Shiites if those Shiites are acting under their orders. And they oppose Shiites where those Shiites are refusing to bend the knee to their foreign Western rule. That's the reason they hate the Islamic Republic of Iran. Not because of any bad things in the Republic. Not because of any shortcomings or failings or mistakes that they have made. They hate the Islamic Republic of Iran because it refuses to follow their orders, refuses to agree to limit the development of their own capacities under the orders of the West. They don't care, frankly, whether someone prays five times a day or not. They don't care the way in which they pray. They don't care how people eat or dress. It's all hokum. It's all smoke in the eyes. All they're trying to do by this great project of division is to ensure another century of division and weakness, exploitation and theft, if they can possibly get away with it. Now, I've said many times in my work on Press TV that the dangers of the war preparations which are underway against Iran are real, but that they would be making the biggest mistake in history. The biggest mistake in history. Israel would be making the biggest mistake in history if it were to launch a military aggression against Iran. Because Iran is not a broken-backed country like Iraq was in 2003, totally riven by internal weakness and decay. Iran is a strong and powerful country with the means and the will and the leadership to respond with a mailed fist against any aggression against it. And moreover, any of these stooge countries around it who allow their air, their sea, their land to be their communications, to be used to permit Israel, the tormentor and the murderer of Palestinian people for 65 years, to attack an Islamic Republic, will also pay a very high price for such treachery and such complicity in what would be a very great crime. And I hope that they have properly calibrated that. I once, quite recently, spoke to an Arab ruler in a Gulf state. And I told him exactly what I've just told you, that if there is an attack on Iran, your oil fields will be on fire within an hour, and they will never be extinguished. He was completely shocked. What? He said, what? But we're against such an attack. Well, if you really are against such an attack, you better tell the Americans quickly. And you won't have to walk far to find them, because they're in your country in massive numbers, in the biggest military bases that the United States possesses in the world. So this poison of sectarianism, which sometimes dresses itself up as democracy, imagine. Mrs. Clinton has announced a new organization in place of the United Nations, where they didn't get their way, called the Friends of Democratic Syria. Who do you think those friends include? Bahrain, where they're shooting down the democracy protesters in the street. Saudi Arabia, which is occupying Bahrain in order to help them shoot down the democracy protesters in the street, as well as shooting its own democracy protesters down in the street. And Qatar, where there's no democracy at all. I mean, you would laugh if it wasn't so tragic. The Friends of Democratic Syria include some of the unfreest countries on the earth. So whatever it is they're after in Syria, and personally I wish the people of Syria every success in reaching a negotiated settlement and free elections for a parliament and a president, which can be done, should be done, must be done, and I hope will be done. But whatever Mrs. Clinton's after in Syria, it certainly can't be democracy. It's hypocrisy these people believe in, not democracy. We are religious people here. We believe in the prophets, peace be upon them. Mrs. Clinton and Mr. Cameron and Mr. Blair and Mr. Brown before them believe in the prophets and how to get a piece of them. That's the difference between them and us. That's why I believe that God is with us. Wassalamu alaikum. Thank you very much indeed.